Good morning. This is hour number two of our morning talk program, Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. This past summer's record fuel prices led many consumers and also government planners to look for alternatives to travel by air and auto. Could trains be the answer? Well, there are a lot of people who would say the answer to that question is yes, indeed, trains can be the answer. This morning in this hour, we'll try to talk about the future of both urban and long-distance rail in the United States. And we have two guests joining us. Robert Fuentes is fellow with the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. He's interested in a number of things related to metropolitan growth and development, and is an expert on transportation and infrastructure, among other things. He is also affiliated professor with Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute. Also joining us is Michael Dukakis. He is now a distinguished professor at Northeastern University in the Department of Political Science, was the governor of Massachusetts, and was the Democratic Party's nominee for president in the U.S. In 1988. He also served as the vice chair of the Amtrak Reform Board from 1998 until 2003, and is someone who has been known for a long time as an advocate, very strong advocate for passenger rail. So as we talk with both of the guests, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that would mean that if you're listening around around Illinois and Indiana on the air, or across the country, actually, on the internet, you may use the toll-free line, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Any point here, questions are welcome. Well, Mr. Puentes, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also Governor Dukakis, thank you very much for joining us.
Let me
start with you, Governor Dukakis, because as I said, you're somebody who has been known for a long time as an advocate for passenger rail. Tell me what you think the potential is for rail in this country.
I think it's huge. And the fact that we are so far behind our friends in Europe and in Asia is really, I think, a national embarrassment, David. You go to Europe, you go to Japan, you're riding on 200-mile-an-hour trains. Every major city and metropolitan area has an excellent public transportation system. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you that's not the picture here. Now, it's not because we don't have the potential to do so. We have an extensive rail network that covers the country. And in point of fact, turning that rail network into a first-class national rail passenger system isn't that difficult, and it's not that expensive. But with the exception of the Northeast Corridor, we're still putzing along at 70 or 80 miles an hour. I mean, we were doing that 100 years ago. And our competitors are just putting us in their rearview mirror. So my hope is that in an interesting kind of way, this economic mess we're in will be at least one reason why we get cracking on this and the president-elect's stimulus package, which I hope and expect will include a substantial component for getting moving on this kind of a national rail passenger system really would be a great way to start it off. And I'm really quite optimistic. In fact, looks as if the president-elect and the vice president-elect are actually going to take the train to Washington from Philly. If that isn't a sign that we finally have an administration that is committed to this, I don't know what is. So apparently Obama's going to leave Philadelphia, pick Joe Biden up in Wilmington, and they're going to stop in Baltimore and then head to D.C. So I hope that's a sign of good things ahead.
Well, I think Senator Biden famously, isn't the story that he takes the train home every night?
Every night.
From work?
During the campaign, this would be the most train-friendly administration in history. I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Let me turn to Mr. Puentes. What sort of things, as I mentioned here, that you're particularly interested, well, you're interested in a lot of things, but transportation and infrastructure. What, to be able to realize the potential that Governor Dukakis was just talking about, what has to happen, do you think?
Well, look, the federal government has to lead the national transportation program. The problem that we've had for the last couple of years is that the federal government has been adrift when it comes to figuring out where and how Americans are traveling and where our national transportation investments are made. Our current federal transportation program writ large, beyond just rail, is as close to a blank check as the federal government comes to writing. And the federal government hasn't taken a lead role in a lot of areas of transportation policy. Now, the problem with rail is that clearly this is an area where only the national government can lead, because we're talking about how Americans get between metropolitan areas, how they get from coast to coast, and how they get between states. And the issue is just too big for the states to deal with on their own. They certainly need to be direct and willing partners when it comes to a reinvigorated rail system. But this is absolutely an area where the federal government, where the national government needs to have a primary role. And I'm not just talking about handing out the money, but as the federal government, as the nation uses this opportunity to think differently about its infrastructure, as Governor Dukakis mentioned, inner city rail needs to be part and parcel of that. We need to have a frank and rigorous debate about it, and no more ideological bends on one way or another. We need to make investments in those kinds of projects that are going to generate high returns. And in many cases, in most cases, I think intercity rail does that.
Mm. Let me go back to Governor Dukakis. Can you just say how much now is the federal government spending on rail, and how much more do you think we should be spending?
Well, listen to these numbers, David. We're currently spending approximately $40 billion federal dollars a year. That doesn't include state and local for highways. About $16 billion for airports and the airlines. $1.6 billion for the nation's national rail passenger system, if you can believe this. I mean, those are the numbers, and they're absurd. And it's not that there aren't plans out there. Virtually every region of the country wants this. Your 10-state Midwestern region has had a first-rate plan for connecting Chicago with each of the major Midwestern cities, including, by the way, Champaign-Urbana, which does have train service, you know, but it's pretty slow. And by the way, without getting into the debate over O'Hare, about a third of the flights out of O'Hare are for 350 miles or less. So if you had a first-class passenger rail system serving the Midwest and connecting Chicago with each of the major Midwestern cities from Cleveland on the east to Des Moines on the west, and that plan has been in existence. I mean, it was developed when I was on the Amtrak board. You could open up O'Hare by another 25% or 30% simply by investing in rail, apart from the environmental benefits and downtown to downtown and kind of trips and all that kind of stuff. And the Midwest is not alone. The Southeast wants it. Florida wants it. The West Coast wants it. As a matter of fact, ridership on Amtrak trains in California, which is supposed to be such a car-loving place, is skyrocketing. And so the stage is set, really. Now, fortunately, we just got the best Amtrak bill in history out of the Congress with a broad bipartisan majority. And the president, believe it or not, signed it. Now, it did have veto-proof majority, so maybe that was one of the reasons why he did so. But if this bill is fully financed and funded by the Congress, and it provides about $2.9 billion a year for Amtrak, and that's what we're talking about, around $3 billion a year, we would have the resources to get moving on these plans and get cracking on, for example, the Midwest plan, and we could move along at that rate on an annual basis very nicely and very effectively.
Hmm. Well, it seems obviously that is a significant amount of money, although when you compare it with, as you say, the amount of money we're spending on airports and for the road system, just doubling what we're doing now, it seems like $3 billion is, you know, with the way the federal government spends money, that doesn't seem like a whole lot of money.
2 weeks in Iraq, David. Hmm. It's 2 weeks in Iraq. That's what it represents. Think about it.
I have a caller here. I'll tell you what, why don't we get to them rather than make them wait any longer. They've been patient, and we'll get them right in. Someone who is calling from Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello. I worked on the freight line here in Champaign for about 34 years. When back in the 70s and 80s, when we did our own labor books and our own submitted our own payrolls, this question has to do with how Amtrak is funded from the how the railroad pays the freight lines. They said that we should attribute all of our money when working on the main line to Amtrak. And I said, well, they just run a couple light trains two or three times a day. And why would we, you know, all of the work would be for the freight lines because they wear out the rails faster. So they said, no, that's the way we do it. So charge all of your expense money and your motels and everything to Amtrak. And I always questioned the railroad is, are they overcharging Amtrak? And I thought, wouldn't it be better to have like a ticket sales split, like a 60-40 or something with the freight rail lines, and that would encourage usage? Could you answer that question on how they fund, what money flows to the freight lines to use the Amtrak trains on it?
Well, I don't know. Either one of you or both of you can take a shot at that. Governor or Mr. Puentes, you want to try that?
Apologies. I mean, it's a really good question. I mean, of the 22,000-mile network, Amtrak only owns about 650 miles of that track, primarily between Boston and Washington. So, therefore, Amtrak must contend with freight and commuter rail, in fact, the owners of the tracks for service time. This arrangement greatly affects things like on-time performance, even though, in principle, the passenger service is supposed to receive priority. We know that, when fuel prices were on the way up and freight shippers were moving more to transporting goods by rail as opposed to truck, it was adding to more congested problems. And we have less freight one rail track today than we have than we had just a couple of decades ago. So all this impacts Amtrak as well. When we think about where the national government, where the federal government should be engaged when it comes to Amtrak, this is absolutely something that we need to sort out, is what the roles and responsibilities are between these different entities, between the private sector and the public sector, and how we prioritize a mode that, quite frankly, we've tried, you know, indirectly or directly to dismantle for a number of years. It's an untenable situation. As the governor mentioned, it's completely opposite of what most other countries are doing.
David, let me throw in a couple of words as well. And mm-hmm. It's been a while since I've been on the Amtrak board, but I don't think Amtrak is required to pay more than very modest amounts of money for the use of the rail. I mean, part of the deal when Amtrak was created and took over what was a money-losing operation for the freights was that outside of the Northeast Corridor, which had gone bankrupt under the Penn Central, which is one of the reasons why we were able to acquire that track, we would be running over the freight railroads, and they would be assuming responsibility for their trackage and expenses and so on and so forth. And I don't think Amtrak pays a great deal for that. We do have, Amtrak does have incentive payments to the freights if their on-time performance is what it ought to be. Unfortunately, as Rob pointed out, in many of these cases, the freights gum up the Amtrak operation, and they never even qualify for the incentive payments. There are one or two freights in the country that actually do a very good job of accommodating Amtrak trains, and they get some of these incentive payments. But I don't think whatever was happening in the 70s and 80s, I don't think that's the case today. I may be wrong, but I don't think that's the case today. Essentially, Amtrak runs over the freight lines because of the agreement way back in the 60s and 70s that the freights would have that responsibility. But as you've just heard, part of the problem is that there's a lot of freight congestion. They can't get out of the way. A lot of these rail rights-of-way that used to be double-tracked are now only single-tracked. And one of the ways to speed up inner-city rail service is to go back out and double-track those lines so you can separate the freights from the Amtrak trains. That would not be difficult. I mean, the real estate is there. You don't have to take single house. You don't have to take single business. It's just a question of getting them back to two or even three-track operations so you can separate out your passenger trains from rail or build sidings where the freights hopefully can tuck themselves in while the Amtrak train goes by. But, again, much of this is really quite modest. And we're not talking about more than essentially about $3 billion a year. If we could get that Amtrak on an annual basis, Amtrak could go out and really do a job. And by the way, Amtrak right now is $300 or $400 million worth of projects that could go out to bid tomorrow if it was part of the proposed stimulus package. So we're really not talking about huge amounts of money here. And part of this is actually working closely with the freights. I mean, after all, we have a major stake in having an excellent rail freight network as well. And as you've just heard, the amount of freight being carried by trains has been going up steadily. So there's a real opportunity here for close cooperation between the freights and Amtrak. But it does need, as Robert's pointed out, national leadership on this, and that's what I hope we're going to get from the new administration.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller.
Well, I'd like to suggest that a ticket sales split with Amtrak revenues would be a win-win situation, and it would increase ridership. And then I had another question. In this area, you have to call, well, everybody, you call on Amtrak for full reserve trains now, and they're booked up. Amtrak says they don't have the cars, and then they also added, when I talked about it to them, they said, look, we've got upgraded our equipment. Aren't you really happy with the cars? And I said, well, you're only running 6 cars on our train that goes between 4 major metropolitan areas, all the way to New Orleans, Jackson, Memphis, and Chicago. And I said, there's no excuse to have a full train. You just stick another car on the end. These engines can pull 100 cars. And it doesn't interfere with the freight railroad to have just one train go by that's long or one train that goes by that's short. It's the same thing. I was wondering if maybe they could take either the old cars that they get rid of and put them on the end for cheap seats, or else they could have the automakers manufacturing rail cars now. Have any comment on those?
Well, if the auto companies could make a rail car, it would make all kinds of sense. You know, nobody in the United States, with a couple of rare exceptions, can make a passenger train for you any longer. I mean, it can't make light rail. I mean, it can't make I spent hundreds of millions of dollars as governor on transit equipment when I was governor of Massachusetts. It was all purchased from foreign companies. I mean, it's really, really pathetic. So I think the idea of getting back to that, whether or not the automobile companies could do it, they do make buses, as good ones, and I think one way to rescue the automobile companies these days is to give them a big contract for buses, because they all of them make buses or bus chassis, and they could do that. We've got 80 cars sitting around, I think, at Beech Grove in Indianapolis that could be rehabbed and put back out on the tracks within a matter of months. Again, it's all about money. So that's another piece of this stimulus package, which makes all kinds of sense. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we've got crowded trains. We've got people packing these trains. And at the same time, now that we seem to have a go-ahead from the Congress with a reasonably decent piece of legislation, I want to see Amtrak, the new Amtrak, out ordering additional equipment. If we can make it in the United States, great. If we can't, then we're going to have to order it from our friends in Canada or wherever they make it. But you know, it does take a commitment, David. If the nation is prepared to commit itself, I'll never forget, I had a conversation once with Jack Welch, who was, of course, then the CEO of GE, and is a native of Salem, Massachusetts. And I was asking him why GE wouldn't get into the train business. Well, of course they are. They make locomotives. And they make very good locomotives, and they ship, I think, now 300 to 400 of them all over the world. But they don't make passenger cars. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, look, Mike, if this country is prepared to make a commitment to rail, and he said, by the way, I'm a train guy. My father was a conductor on the Boston and Maine Railroad. I was riding the trains with him when I was a kid. If the country is willing to make a substantial commitment on a long-term basis to rail, then we'll get into the train business. But this is back in the 80s, if they're spending billions on missiles and they're not spending anything on trains, then we're going to make missiles. And I've never forgotten that conversation. So I hope we're on the threshold of a long-term commitment to investment in passenger rail. And if that's the case, then conceivably our caller's idea about getting this country back in the train business makes sense. In the meantime, we've got these 80 cars. They're sitting there. All it takes is a relatively modest amount of money to get them back in shape, and I hope we can do that starting right away.
Let me introduce again the guests that we have for this hour. Michael Dukakis, a distinguished professor in the Department of Political Science at Northeastern University, former governor of the state of Massachusetts, Democratic candidate for president. He served on the Amtrak Reform Board. He was the vice chair from 1998 until 2003. And as I said at the beginning of the program, someone who is well known for having been and continuing to be a strong advocate for the idea of passenger rail. Also joining us is Robert Puentes. He's a fellow with the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative and works on a number of areas, including transportation and infrastructure, as well as things like urban planning and growth management. Questions are welcome here. We're talking about rail, the future of rail here in the United States. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here on our line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. You raised one of my pet peeves about O'Hare. The expansion of O'Hare was lobbied hard by Dalian Blagojevich. If we had not done that, you're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars to do that, taking land around the collar counties and depreciating the value of properties nearby. If you were to do what you suggested, that grand plan, connect Omaha and Des Moines, Quad Cities, Chicago, and the rest of the outlying peripheral cities, you do a couple things. You improve infrastructure along those lines. You create mom-and-pop businesses so that can the tax dollars stay in the state of Illinois instead of going down to Dallas-Fort Worth or Atlanta. Then, if fuel gets short, you can electrify. You can't electrify an airplane, so I'll listen to your comment. Thank you.
I mean, well, clearly there's lots of good reasons to do airport expansion. Whether or not the O'Hare expansion is necessary, I don't know the specifics there. Whether or not having increased passenger rail capacity would directly affect that. I think intuitively it would. But it is a great point. And again, it gets back to my larger concern about the program is that we're not making these broad connections. We're one of the only industrialized countries in the world that has a separate bunch of federal. We have a Federal Railroad Administration, a Federal Aviation Administration, a Federal Highway Administration, a Federal Transit Administration. These agencies don't talk to one another. And we don't do any kind of holistic planning in any kind of meaningful way. And that's why we have these ridiculous situations that the governor pointed out where we have so many flights going less than 500 miles, 250 miles every day, which clearly could be served by a functioning, efficient rail system. We could do it in an energy-independent, environmentally sustainable way and have all these economic benefits that the caller just mentioned, these ancillary things that come along with it that you just don't get when you have massive airport expansion. So as this conversation about airport congestion continues in the New York metro, Chicago, Atlanta, I mean, all across the country, we need to think not just about how to expand the belt so that we can shove more and more planes through it, but how we use different modes. And Amtrak, as the governor mentioned and others, is a major untapped resource that we should be invigorating in the near term.
I mean, I don't know whether we're going to lose the shuttle, the plane shuttle here in the Northeast Corridor soon, although there's some suggestion that that's probably going to be the case. But already, trains in the Northeast Corridor have a substantial majority of the market share as compared with planes, and with good reason. I mean, if you can get, and we some modest improvements between Boston and New York and some perhaps between New York and Washington. But if you can make that trip downtown to downtown in 3 hours or less, you beat the plane every time, downtown to downtown, no question about it. Not to mention the fact it's far more reliable, particularly during winter storms and summer storms, for that matter. I mean, it's just much higher degree of reliability, and that opens up a tremendous amount of capacity that's now being used by the shuttles in the Northeast Corridor for longer flights from our airports, which is, after all, what the airports ought to be doing. Now, I don't know where I've kind of followed the O'Hare dispute from time to time here, but and there may be reasons why O'Hare needs expansion, but if you have the kind of Midwest passenger rail transportation system that we're talking about, which may not be 200 miles an hour, but it certainly could be 120 miles an hour between cities. I mean, that has to increase the capacity of O'Hare by giving people an alternative, which, again, is downtown to downtown, all weather, much more reliable, and would, as the caller said, do wonders for the communities through which the train passes, because every one of those older downtowns is going to benefit from the fact that there's regular high-speed train service running through them. on an ongoing basis.
Let me just ask a quick question. Maybe I'll ask Robert Buendez, and if Governor DeCongress, you want to weigh in, and you certainly may. But it's an infrastructure question. We were talking earlier about the problem of freights and passenger trains having to share the same rails, and I think that Governor DeCongress earlier made reference to the fact that one of the complaints that people have about the trains here, about Amtrak, is that they're slow. Are to be able to deal with all of these kinds of problems, and perhaps overall we're talking about an increase in volume of traffic, are we going to have to lay more track? Can we continue to use the same system, or is that just not going to work?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's tough. I mean, again, given that, the examples that the governor mentioned, the Northeast Corridor, and I totally agree with the governor, you'd be crazy to fly from Washington to New York. I mean, the train is on time.
Although some people do it for reasons I don't understand.
Indeed, it's safe, reliable, and efficient because Amtrak, I think, owns the track. And these things, the trains that move between these metros do seem to be safe and reliable and all that. It is this issue that the trains have to share the track with the freight companies across the country. And that is a major issue. Now, the problem I think that we were getting to is that when we're trying to move between metropolitan areas, I mean, the thing about Amtrak service is that it is almost entirely metropolitan. I mean, we think about Amtrak as a national service, and certainly it provides rail alternatives to folks in rural areas in Montana and other places that wouldn't have it otherwise. But about 98% of Amtrak riders get on and get off trains within metropolitan areas. It's not just about New York. It really is something that connects our major metropolitan areas. And so when we think about laying new track, we're not thinking about wide open spaces where land is cheap and plentiful. We're talking about within cities and within older suburbs, and trying to build new infrastructure in these places is really, really difficult, very complex, and extraordinarily expensive. So I think that one way we can at least help address that is, as the governor mentioned, as we talked about, for the federal government to show some leadership and to make this a priority, we'll start to see some of those log jams when it comes to finding right-of-way a little easier. We can have those conversations better when there is a coherent, holistic plan for travel, as opposed to these one-offs, which is, I think, how we're doing it today. So your point is exactly right, that we're going to have to lay some new tracks, but we can't be blind to just how hard it is to do within existing places.
Well, let's go talk with another caller here on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, great conversation. I had a chance to take Amtrak when I was a kid and a couple other times, and I'm a train buff. I love going Amtrak. The problem is, in the last decade or so, if you compare it to air travel, it's expensive. I mean, I have relatives out west, and for me to go see them on a train, it's also not just only time-consuming, it's very expensive. In some cases, it's as comparable to an airline. It's $350, $400 to go out there versus, you know, flying, which is probably a little bit less, and plus time-wise. And the other thing is I found out lately was they also make stops every single city and town between here and L.A. It's astronomical. I mean, it used to be more functional. You have express trains out of Naperville, for instance, up north in northern Illinois. And I'm wondering, is there a way we can make that more affordable? I mean, the time isn't so much matter to me as much as affordability.
Yeah, and I suppose that some people would argue that even if you want to travel in some comfort, you want to have a sleeping car, that's going to get you even more expense. And maybe I'll save that question of the amenities associated with traveling. But what can you say about that, particularly the fact that if people are just looking at the simple matters of dollar and cents, that it can actually be more expensive to take the train than to fly?
Well, coach travel is quite reasonable and very competitive and usually substantially less expensive than a plane. There's no question if you want a sleeper, and if you want to take the Empire Builder out to Seattle, you want to take the Zephyr to San Francisco, you want to take the Southwest Chief down to Los Angeles, and you want a sleeper, it's going to be expensive. On the other hand, I don't know that this helps, but if you treat it as a hotel on wheels, it's really quite reasonable. But those long-distance trains do serve a purpose, and it's very important that we continue to run them. On the other hand, if we build a kind of ridership that I think we can with much improved service between cities, I don't think there's any question that from a price standpoint, we can price those trips substantially less than what airlines are charging us, particularly now. But there's no question that if you want a sleeper, it's going to be more expensive, and we've got to understand that unless we're prepared to pour subsidies into sleepers, and I'm not sure we are. So on the coach side, price is right. When it comes to the sleeper, you're going to have to pay a substantial amount, but you get a very interesting experience.
Well, I suppose there are some people who say that, in fact, that there is a certain pool of potential passengers out there who would be willing to pay the money if you could give them a really good travel experience, if you could give them a really comfortable compartment, if you could give them good food. There are people who actually would say, yes, if it would be a good – if you could make it like the Orient Express – darn right, I'll pay it. And the only problem is that we don't have anything like that in this country.
Well, between April and October, those long distance trains are full, David, and those sleepers are full. Believe me, they're very, very popular. But remember, it's a vacation experience essentially. I don't think you're going to find somebody who's on a business trip going from Chicago to Los Angeles isn't going to take the plane, and that's perfectly understandable. Yeah. So, but there's huge demand even now for the sleepers, and those long distance trains are carrying a lot of people.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And there is still a big public policy component here, and the governor mentioned the subsidies. I mean, there's no doubt that Amtrak has received significant public subsidies since it was created in the early 1990s. That's $30 billion that they've received during that time, though. Pales in comparison to what we're pumping into the airlines right now. Estimates from 1971 to 2004 are about $2 trillion.
That's for airlines?
For airlines.
Yeah.
So we're again, as we're thinking about how we move between metros and how people are going to get around, we're just not prioritizing this kind of travel. There's a lot of folks who would suggest that we're actually trying to dismantle the system by just starving it to death. We look at where the U.S. spends right now. We're somewhere between Estonia and Turkey in terms of the level support for national rail service. So other countries have picked up on this calculus, but I'm with the governor. I'm optimistic that with the new administration, with the new frame for transportation and infrastructure in this country, we'll finally see it get its due.
We have several.
That's the other thing, yep. David. People say, well, Amtrak keeps losing money. No national rail system in the world makes money overall, although there are lines that make money. I mean, the Acela makes money above the rails. I mean, it's profitable. Northeast Card is profitable. But they don't make money. On the other hand, highways don't make money. Mm-hmm. Airports don't make money. I mean, we're pouring billions and billions in subsidies in both our highway and airport systems. And yet nobody says, well, it's Amtrak that loses money. I mean, this is a public investment, whether it's highways, airports, or rail, or transit. It's a public investment. We make it. And the question is, how do you make it? And how do you make it in a way that builds a first-class national rail passenger system as an important part of our overall national transportation system?
Well, that it raises the question why it is that we have, when you think about the way that we think about traveling and the kinds of government support to different modes of travel, why it is that trains ended up on the bottom?
Well, it's an interesting historical kind of analysis. When we came out of World War II, we hadn't had any new cars in 5 years. I'm old enough to remember when those first new cars arrived in the neighborhood and all of us kids walking around kind of touching them. I mean, the new Hudsons and the Kaisers and the Frasers and the Studebakers, those are names from the past, and the Nashes and so on and so forth. But everybody was into cars, and they were relatively inexpensive. We hadn't had any all during World War II, and everybody was going to drive everywhere. Well, we began investing billions in highways, and then, of course, we started investing billions in airports. Now, in the meantime, the railroads were privately run, and we just kind of assumed, I think, that they would continue to be privately run and be profitable. But if you pour billions into highways and airports and nothing into rail, sooner or later, your rail system is going to begin to feel it. And that's what happened. And by the late 60s, the private railroads said, look, we're making money on freight. We're not making money on passengers. You take it. We don't want it. And that's what led to the creation of Amtrak. But we've always had that strange dichotomy between the way we look at highways and airports and those investments, which far exceed anything we've spent on Amtrak, and the Amtrak side of things. Now, I think that's changing. And my hope and expectation is that under the new administration, we're going to stop making that kind of distinction. And if we do, then we can get going on building a first-class national transportation system generally, but one in which high-speed rail is a very important part.
I think it's changing, too. I think that it's interesting. We talk about subsidies for railroads and transit. We think about investments when it comes to highways. But we're witnessing dramatic changes in travel behavior in this country. Just in the last year, total driving has slowed down or has dropped by 10 billion miles. Americans are driving 10 billion miles less than they did from October 2007 to October of 2008. We're seeing this in states from coast to coast, in metropolitan areas from coast to coast. Dramatic, dramatic changes. Some of this is due to the increase in gas prices. There's no doubt about it. When prices spiked, people did begin to drive less. But two things. We know that prices have gone down and people have continued to drive less over the last couple of months. And we detected these trends, you know, before this increase in gas prices, that people, things were slowing down dramatically and they were kind of plateauing in terms of this growth in driving. It's only the gas prices just pushed it over the edge and driving has plummeted. So at the same time that people have been driving less and the economy has been suffering for larger reasons, we know that Amtrak is way up. Transit use is up from coast to coast and for every mode. At the same time, we're witnessing the largest sustained drop in driving that this nation has ever seen. It's absolutely incumbent upon Congress and the administration as they craft this new recovery package and as we think about the future of transportation in this country that we recognize these trends and don't just do more of the same and plow money into a mode that certainly was helpful for this country in the 1950s but may or may not be the same, you know, have the same role as it will in the future. As we try to move to something more environmentally sustainable, more energy independent, we need to think about these other modes.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Very quickly, let me introduce again the guests, and we'll take some more calls. Robert Puentes is a fellow with the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative, works on a number of issues, including transportation and infrastructure. Also joining us by telephone is Michael Dukakis. He's now professor in the Department of Political Science at Northeastern University in Boston, former governor of Massachusetts, former Democratic Party nominee for president, 1988, also formerly serving on the Amtrak Reform Board and longtime advocate of passenger rail. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Have a caller up next in St. Louis. We'll talk with them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to thank your guests for talking about the comparison of how to fund highways and airports versus Amtrak. And because it's something that is a big source of frustration for me when talking about rail with friends. I'm a big supporter of rail, and I wanted to give a plug for a couple of groups that are working to get appropriate funding to improve and expand our rail system. First is the Midwest High-Speed Rail Coalition, which is working to develop a high-speed rail system in the Midwest with Chicago as the main hub. And the second is the National Association of Railroad Passengers. And that one is working for better funding nationwide. And I will hang up and listen to the rest of the show. Thank you.
All right. I don't know how you want to comment on that. I guess one thing I am interested in is having both of you, and here, maybe I'll start with Mr. Prentice, talk about the potential for high-speed rail, particularly, you know, is it possible that we could have trains here in the United States that move at the speeds that some of the trains move in Japan and Europe, and what would that take?
Well, there's no reason. I mean, technologically, certainly we can do it. We have the innovation. We have, you know, the capacity to do it here in this country. But, you know, we're so far away from some of that in this country. I mean, the Acela line between Washington and Boston is probably the best we've got. And that functions, I think, pretty well. If we had Acela-like service around the country, you know, then maybe I think we should be thinking about a 300-mile-an-hour kind of train. I'm not trying to restrict how far we go here, but I mean we're really far away from that in this country. High-speed rail takes a lot of really straight, right-of-way. The trains can't be making a lot of curves, obviously. You can't be making a lot of stops. I think there are a couple of corridors that are ripe for that. I think L.A. to Las Vegas or some parts of California, I think the governor may know better which ones are, you know, really ripe for that kind of investment. But at this point, I'd really just like to see a frank and real rigorous conversation about where we need to make these investments, where we can get the most bang for the buck. You know, Amtrak is the result of this weird political alignment in Washington of rural states and urban states and Northeast and all this, you know, but it's kind of been that peanut butter approach and spreading it around the country that's, I think, been difficult and almost untenable, you know, to support a service that really can, you know, reshape travel patterns. So I know this is a long answer to the question, but I think that high-speed rail certainly has a role in this country in the future. I don't think it's absolutely inevitable, but I just don't want us to lose sight of what the challenges are right now. We're facing some dramatic challenges when it comes to Amtrak service today.
Yeah, David, I would say that in much of the country, the Midwest, for example, and we just heard about the Midwest High-Speed Rail Association, which has done the work. That's this 10-state coalition that's been working on this for several years and developed the plan. Frank Busalacci, who's a very capable Secretary of Transportation in Wisconsin, heads up a national state advocacy group for passenger rail. He's got about 34 states that are members of this and so on. So it's been a lot of leadership and a lot of good work done in the Midwest. But I think on existing rights-of-way, we're talking about speeds in the 110, 120, maybe 125 range, which, by the way, is what Great Britain has for the most part, with the exception of the Channel, and it works extremely well. I mean, it's pretty fast speeds. I mean, it would get you from St. Louis to Chicago in, 3 hours or less at that speed. The one place, in addition to the Northeast, where we now have real prospects for 200-mile-an-hour trains is California. Mm-hmm. To the great credit of the California voters, they've just approved an initiative which commits the state to coming up with $10 billion to be matched by the feds and the private sector for a first-class European-type or Asian-type, if you want to use that term, high-speed rail system, speeds of 200, 220 miles an hour, connecting Sacramento, San Francisco, San Jose, the Central Valley, Los Angeles, Riverside, and San Diego. And you'll be able to get on a train in downtown San Francisco and be in Los Angeles in 2 hours and 40 minutes, 55 minutes from Los Angeles to San Diego. And this isn't Buck Rogers stuff. I mean, this is simply using the existing technology, which has been serving Europe and Japan for many, many years. And they are now hard at work on this. I think the prospects for the federal match are good. And so in California, of all places, the place where the automobile flourished, you've got a majority of the voters now saying, we want high-speed trains. And voting to raise the money to do so. So I'm very encouraged by that. But in much of the country, service in the 110, 115, 120, 25 range is entirely possible at relatively low cost. And so my view is we ought to be doing that and moving on that as quickly as we possibly can while we help California to build its system, improve the Acela, and then look, as we've just heard, look at other possibilities for this kind of thing. But it's much, much less expensive to take existing rights away and turn them into relatively high-speed train service. The high-speed, the 200-mile-an-hour trains need their own right-of-way. They can't operate with freight and commuter rail and all that kind of stuff. So that's why the California plan is so exciting. And is real and is now moving ahead.
Yeah. Well, that's what you got. They've got to have their own tracks. You can't have grade crossings.
Right.
You can't have
a
lot of curves. Well, what's the on existing tracks though? How much more speed could we get?
You can get it up. You can get up to into the 120, 125
huh.
range.
Okay.
And you got to separate grade crossings and all that kind of stuff. But that is not hugely expensive. And for the most part, those rights of way are available for that kind of improvement. We also have a lot of relatively unused rail lines that serve parallel cars. You could actually take those over and make them exclusively passenger. And that is true, by the way, in the Midwest. There are very poorly used rights-of-way that are available and might well be converted into much higher speed rail service. But believe me, if over the course of the next 10 to 15 years, we could build a national rail passenger system with average speeds in the 110 to 125 range, particularly in places like the Midwest and the Southeast and in Florida and those places, it would be a huge improvement while we move ahead with this genuinely high-speed system in California.
We have a couple minutes left here. We have some other callers, so we'll try to get as many as we can. We'll go next to Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Yes, hi. I just have a couple of comments. One is, I don't understand, I guess, why the government always seems to be reactive and not proactive on issues that, such as, you know, a national transportation policy. And then regarding the caller, I think it was the caller before last, when he was talking about the cost, I actually happen to agree with the caller more than your guests in that I think the cost is also extremely high relative to other costs, because a couple of years ago I tried to go from Indiana to Kansas City, and basically I checked out the train and Amtrak. I checked out Amtrak, the plane, and driving, and the plane and Amtrak actually were going to take longer than driving, and Amtrak cost more than the plane, and they both cost twice what it was going to cost me to drive. So in the end, I drove because it was way more convenient and less expensive. And until the public transport, and this was not for a vacation, this was to get from A to B, and it wasn't a, you know, it was so, until those kind of costs become somewhat competitive, and other issues, like, for example, my pets travel with me, and that's a hassle on an airplane, and you know, when you're not just traveling for a vacation. And so I think until some of those kinds of issues, as far as efficiency and cost and the ability to do things like bring your pets or whatever, become part of the system, because I've traveled a lot in Europe on their systems, and they're just so much easier than any of the systems here that I've tried to work with. So that's just a comment, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
I appreciate the comment.
And
go ahead.
Yeah, the caller, I mean, is right. The problem is it's in economics. All right, we don't price the transportation system correctly. We don't price for things like carbon emissions, for example. One of the reasons I think that you have a different network in Europe is they consider the cost of carbon that results from greenhouse gas emissions from transportation to a large degree when they are talking about where they're going to invest and what kind of subsidies they have for the transportation network. If we calculated things like that into the system, I think you would see prices go down on modes that are greenhouse gas friendly, and prices go up for modes where carbon is a real cost when it comes to emissions, aviation and highways in particular. So once we start to have a better approach to figuring out these returns on investment when it comes to transportation, which we don't do in this country at all, I think that we'll start to see some movement when it comes to the pricing of the system and ticket prices in general.
Okay, we got about a minute left. Governor, you want to make a final comment?
Oh, well, let's take another call unless you're running out of time.
Well, I'm not sure we quite have time for another call.
I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you on this. I'm very excited about the new administration and its plans for this. Obviously, the public wants to make its voices heard on it, but I don't think there's any question. I mean, I haven't seen a poll for years in this country that doesn't show overwhelming support for much improved rail passenger service. And we finally seem to have an administration coming into office that understands this, understands how important it is in terms of the environmental issues that we're facing, the global warming issues we're facing, not only that, but the mobility of the American people and the importance of having a first-class rail system for our economy. So I'm excited, and I think we all are who have been fighting this fight for a long time. And I'm just very grateful to you for putting us on and giving us an opportunity to spend some time with you.
Well, we appreciate the time. We'll have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Michael Dukakis. He's now teaching at Northeastern University in Boston, former Massachusetts governor and Democratic Party nominee for president, 1988. Governor Dukakis, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And Robert Puentes, he's fellow with the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And, of course, if you're interested in what's going on there at Brookings, you can go to their website, which is brookings.edu. And, Mr. Puentes, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Governor.